Thank you for the invitation to come here. So today I'm going to try to argue to that we can get some useful information that maybe that we can hopefully test against experiments from ABS-CFT, particular things related to the Brassard bound, the soft phoneron, and the Rick fireball. And the work that I described here is in this paper with Kinshu Kang at Brown, and in this paper by myself. Okay, so a very detailed summary of my talk is as follows. After an introduction and describing the setup of Polchinski and Strassler for high energy QCD, I'm going to describe the particular scenario for what black hole production in the gravity dual means divided by Steve Gooding here, and some questions that I had that I wanted to answer. And in order to answer these questions, I used the formalism which dates back to Hoft, which uses the gravitational shock waves of Ikerbos Drexel type. By scattering these waves in higher curved dimensions, I'm going to try to calculate for some string corrections and see what that does, and then to calculate the string Ikerbos Drexel scattering in the gravity dual and use the map to QCD. Then I'm going to describe to you a model, old model by Heisenberg for the saturation of the Brassard bound, and I'm going to tell you that this maps precisely to what we obtain in a gravity dual. Then I'm going to show to you what I believe is corresponding to the soft phoneron behavior of QCD. I'm going to describe this in the context of general gauge theories first, and then concentrate on real QCD and compare with experiments. And then I'm going to try to describe some properties of the Rick fireball using ABS-CFT and conclude. Okay. So, what I'm going to try to derive for you. High energy QCD that is at fixed T and high S, for high energy QCD, the total cross section goes like a very small power of the energy experimentally given here, but this power is not unitary at S length infinity. The maximal unitary behavior is given by the Brassard bound, whose saturation is given here. So it's log squared S with a dimensional constant in front, and the dimensional constant is either the mass of the lighted blue ball or the pion mass, that is the mass of a almost Goldstone boson. I'm also going to try to describe to you the phenomena at Rick, where one scatters heavy nuclei, in particular gold, at 200 GeV per nucleon, and one observes a fireball of temperature 176 MeV that then decays into very many particles. So I'm going to try to derive this behavior for gauge gravity duality. In the Brassard case, I'm going to talk mostly about the case of where there's a lightest blue ball, but I'm going to give an argument why I see that the same discussion applies when the pion is lightest. And just to keep your attention, what I want to find in the final results will be that for a gravity dual of ABS D plus 1 cross X D bar, small power will be 1 over 7 between these two energy scales, NC 1 quarter and 1 blue ball, about 2 GeV, and NC squared and 1 blue ball is about 10 GeV. And this power, which is 1 over 11 after that, until an unknown, uncalculable energy scale in this uncalculable so far, and maximal Brassard behavior after that. Now also I'm going to argue for you that the Rick fireball is a dual black hole, and I'm going to try to calculate the temperature and find an expression modulo a constant that can in principle be calculated, but I can't calculate it so far. But the interesting thing is what multiplies it is very close to, extremely close to the experimental value. Okay, so we all know what ABS-CFT is, but just to talk about the coordinates I'm going to use. So in the case of a conformal theory, we'll have ABS psi plus some x phi, and ABS, for ABS I'm going to use these two type of coordinates. So, Ochinski and Slatzler showed how to analyze scattering in high-energy QCD via scattering in the gravity dual. So the gauge theory momentum is related to local ABS momentum just by the metric factor. And one analyzes non-conformal gauge theories by just modeling the modification of the gravity dual in the infrared, just by the simplest approximation one can have, putting a cutoff on this value. This is the simplest model, but it gives many good results. And if one put a valid cutoff, we'll have a Randall-Sundrum two-grain model, so the same kind of, I'm going to use that terminology from time to time, although we don't put the cutoff in the ultraviolet. So, as you probably very well know, the model proposed by Wojcinski and Slatzler for scattering things in scattering colorless states in gauge theories is to say that the wave function in the gauge theory is just multiplied by some wave function in the extra dimensions. And then gauge theory amplitude is obtained by integrating the string amplitude convoluted with this wave functions and taking care to rescale the momenta. Corresponding to the string tension in ABS that's related to the scale of ABS in this way, there's a gauge theory string tension related to lambda QCD in a similar way. And then momenta in string units are less equal than QCD momenta in QCD string units. And you might ask, what does it mean to have an amplitude in ABS? Well, at least if ABS is large, one can use flat space amplitude, and otherwise one has to think a little bit how to define things. So then Steve proposed the following thing, that one notices that there's also a Planck scale in the theory, and correspondingly there's a gauge theory Planck scale. And therefore, something interesting should happen when QCD momenta reach this scale, because in the gravity dual, when we reach the Planck scale, we expect to start producing black holes. And black holes, the dimensions have a horizon radius that goes like this. So if one would take just the geometrical cross-section for black hole formation, so just pi r horizon squared, we would get some power of the energy, in particular if v equal to 10, sigma goes like s to 1/7. Moreover, there's another interesting scale. When the size of this black hole that is formed reaches the size of ABS at this particular energy scale in the gauge theory, one would expect that maybe this is the maximum behavior that corresponds to the Frassel bound. I'm going to tell you that it's almost the same, just a little bit of modification.
Sorry, what is
Well, I mean, the maximum Frassel behavior is the maximum behavior you can have in QCD. This seems like the maximum behavior you can have in the gravity dual, so it's a very reasonable.
The black holes can be arbitrarily large in QCD.
No, maximal in the sense that there's no higher energy, it doesn't seem to be a higher energy scale, that's all I mean.
I see, okay, it's the highest energy scale.
The growth of the size changes.
Yeah, so that's
your T-shirt energy scale, okay.
Okay, so in particular, to describe in more detail, what Steve said, yes?
The statement is that's the place where you expect that you'll find these are saturated across on. Bound.
Yeah, the Frassel bound is not, I mean, the cross section continues to grow just log as log squared.
Okay, great, thanks.
So if one would put a point mass of m equals square root s on the infrared cutoff of this gravity dual, then the linearized gravity has a mass scale given here that one can map to the lightest glue volume of QCD. And but of course in the physical case, one not only has glue balls, but one also has pions. The pions are really the lightest excitation of the theory. So to model that, one makes the radian, so the position of the infrared grain, dynamical, and gives it the mass, and that is a almost Dolson boson that can be understood as being mapped to the pion of QCD, of course the scalar pion in this case, obviously. And the two cases are similar in that if one either takes that the linearized metric is of order 1 to calculate roughly the position of the horizon, or equivalently the brain bending, the fluctuation of the radian, and makes it of order 1, in both cases one obtains sigma, which is pi times the corresponding scale squared, that goes like the Frassard bound. So log squared s with the mass scale in front, that's the lightest excitation of the theory, either the mass of the KK mode or the mass of the radian. Okay? All right. So that is very nice, but I just wanted to make things more precise. So the number of questions that I had was, why point mass in the infrared brain works, and why I would like to see it appear as a dynamical statement of scattering things inside ABS, why this geometrical formula is still correct. I mean, it sounds reasonable, but I'd like to understand this better. Why the linearized approximation gives a good estimate, and those string corrections, that are mapped to finite n and finite gn mils, do these things change the results? So to analyze this, I started looking at an idea dating back to Hoff that one can use at high energy in a gravity theory. One can use gravitational shockwaves of the Eichelberg's Excel type to map the scattering. So these shockwaves are just defined by a function, non-trivial function of transverse coordinate, multiplying delta of x plus dx plus squared. And this function is harmonic, satisfies the Poisson equation. And the interesting thing about it is that you can put this shockwave in a general type of gravity duals. And as I showed, for generic gravity duals, one can show that the same equation applies. It's just delta is the Laplacian in the gravitational background. That's a powerful statement. It means that for shockwaves, the linearized solution is always an exact solution. It's very uncharacteristic to gravity, which is usually highly nonlinear.
I'm sorry, what assumptions do you need on geometry for that to be true?
You need to have some symmetry. You need to have something like dx plus square, so four-dimensional.
Translation.
Yeah. Other than that, not much else.
Just curve the left body, I think.
Oh.
And Hoff showed that if you scatter two massless particles just below the Planck scale, very close to it, you can model the scattering by saying that one particle creates a gravitational shockwave, and the second particle moves like a probe on a null geodesic in the shockwave. If you do that, the differential scattering cross-section you obtain is the one of Rutherford scattering, and where you just replace the coupling with the gravitational coupling. So this is a good model for single graviton exchange. And Hoff also suggested that maybe if you go above the Planck scale, you can't treat the second photon just as a probe, so you would need both particles to create gravitational shockwaves. And therefore, even though each shockwave is linear, in the future of the collision, you will get the full nonlinear gravity. And he suggested that one should obtain black hole formation of some sort. Then in 2002, Early and Steve, here I have treated this kind of scattering in the context of flat four dimensions at a non-zero impact parameter and zero impact parameter in higher dimensions, and they've calculated from this the maximum impact parameter as a function of S for the formation of a trapped surface. So from this you derive the cross-section as pi b max squared. So what that means, so the interacting metric is unknown in the future of the collision. I mean, in particular, it has been computed perturbatively by Beth and Payne, Beth and Payne. Yes. You can imagine it's very hard. But you know, you don't learn anything. You can only calculate things perturbatively. But the nice thing about GR is that there is a theorem that says if you find a trapped surface that is a closed surface of zero convergence, that is a surface that doesn't want to expand outward in either null direction, then in the future of this solution, you'll find a horizon forming outside the trapped surface. And just to give you an idea, a trapped surface for a Schwarzschild solution is just the horizon for S2 surface. And we've generalized this formula into higher dimensions, and we gave an estimate of what B max is. You can calculate here, there's an ugly constant that I haven't put explicitly, but one can calculate it. And then the same thing happens, that the maximum entire parameter grows like a power of G root S, the Schwarzschild radius. And correspondingly, sigma, the cross section, also grows like a power of G root S. The other question that I wanted to ask is, what about string corrections? So, in order to analyze this, we scattered string-corrected Ikerbury Zexel shockwaves that are found in the following way. They were found by Amati and Klinczyk. So they equated Hopf scattering in an arbitrary shockwave profile with a resum string calculation for the scattering, and they matched the two results, therefore deriving an effective phi. And taking this string-corrected shockwaves, we use the same kind of generalized formula described before, and we find the impact parameter for this new type of scattering. And we find the result, the result we had before, plus some exponentially small corrections. But here, RS is 2g4 root s, so the Schwarzschild radius in four dimensions. And so you see that at s going to infinity, this object becomes exponentially small. Okay. So now let's try to use this for the gravity dual case.
Sorry, before you go, could you just, mm-hmm. when you estimate the maximum impact parameter at higher dimensions, how do you do that? I mean, see, you look at higher dimensions sort of straight on, head-on collision?
No. Well, no, we gave a construction that would work for finite impact parameters. It's just that solving the actual equations had to be done numerically in the end, and it was done by Wu and Yoshida. But the actual construction, the same construction we used in Fortnum, which is curious to hire, it's just that, you know, it's this sort of boundary value problem you need to find to actually get the solution and actually get the numerical scale. But you can see how the scaling with energy, for example, works out.
So we used an approximation scheme that we checked works very well in the case of four dimensions where Steve could do solve exactly the solution. We used an approximation scheme and found what happened in higher dimensions as well. Okay. All right, so so we want to apply now this for gravity duals, and we saw that the two cases of interest were of scattering inside, either inside ADS or on the infrared brain. So let's look at those two. So inside ADS, we can calculate the shockwave because, as I said, the linear solution is exact. And then find that at large distances, phi goes like 1 over r to the 6th. So we generalize this formula into curved space, which is a huge mess, but one can do it in the end. And one finds the corresponding maximum impact parameter for forming the trapped surface when you scatter two of these things. And the expression is given here. It's, again, a power rs to 1/6 of the Schwarzschild radius, and there's some numerical constant which you can calculate. And first, and then the same thing can be done on the infrared brain. So the shockwave on the infrared brain is given here. C1 is some numerical constant that I didn't put explicitly. And one scatters two of these shockwaves and again finds the maximum impact parameter that goes as expected, like a log of the Schwarzschild impact parameter with 1 over M1 in front. And so now that we have this classical scattering, this classical cross-section, in order to use the formalism of Polchinski and Strassler, we would like to turn it somehow into a quantum amplitude, with a quantum amplitude in the formula, moreover, 2 to 2 quantum amplitude. And, you know, if we had a complete theory of quantum gravity, we could calculate this amplitude. But as we don't, I just use the simplest approximation one can have. They introduce a black disk Eichenholz amplitude that reproduces the cross-section. That is to say, S is e to the I delta, and for B greater than B max, delta is 0, and for B less than B max, imaginary delta is infinite. And if you do that, the imaginary part of the forward elastic amplitude, which by definition is sigma, is pi B max squared, just calculating it from here. But so that reproduces your B max, but then now you also have a simplest model for quantum amplitude that reproduces, for quantum elastic amplitude, 2 to 2. So you just take this amplitude and put it in the Polchinski-Strassler formula, calculate the gauge theory amplitude and corresponding gauge theory cross-section. And the results are the following. So there's you get the same cross-section in the string theory, just multiply with a model-dependent constant, by which I mean a constant that depends on the details, in particular the wave functions in the infrared, the details of the cutoff. The subleading behavior is modified. That's not so interesting. From my point of view, the most interesting part is to see that most of the integral over the ADS comes from a region close enough to the cutoff, but not quite on the cutoff. And so we can effectively consider the scattering as happening close enough to the infrared brain. So, pictorially, what happens is the following. So effectively, we scatter somewhere here, and initially the black hole that are produced feel just flat space, they're small enough. As you increase the energy, they start feeling the curvature of ADS. And as you increase it even further, they reach the infrared brain. And so effectively, one can think of the scattering as really happening on the infrared brain. That's a good enough approximation.
I'm confused. Why do you say that you're not thinking of it as taking place at the infrared brain to begin with?
No, I'm just saying, so I have this amplitude, and I integrate using the Polchinski-Strassler formula, and I look at the integral where it's situated. And it's situated somewhere close to, but not quite on the.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
But if you didn't have an infrared brain there and you had an infrared cutoff, it would be arbitrarily far down the curve.
Yeah.
I'm sorry?
If you didn't have an infrared brain there and you didn't have an infrared cutoff, it would have an arbitrarily far down the curve.
Well, I mean, I don't know the details. In this particular model, what happens is, so the integral is not situated on the infrared brain. you still have some modification there of the wave functions that make it to be just a bit away.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what would happen if you would take some more complicated models. So
it's basically there that you get the highest center of mass energy, for example. And since you sample your flow of energy, that's where you get the most bang for your buck.
Makes sense.
So now let me describe to you an old model by Heisenberg, 1952, for the saturation of the Frassat bound. But you might notice this is before QCD, before the Frassat bound, and before string theory, and yet somehow it managed to describe the saturation of the bound in the gravity duo. So I was pretty impressed with that. The idea is the following. So Heisenberg says if you take two hadrons at high enough energy and you scatter them, they'll get Lorentz contracted, so they'll start looking like pancakes, and in the limit they'll become shock waves, so delta function distributed. Now, these hadrons will also produce some pion field around them, and this pion field distribution will also get Lorentz contracted, and so in the limit there'll be a pion field shock wave. And the model he takes is said the hadron in some sense will dissolve in the pion field, so it will just become irrelevant, and the only thing that reminds you there was a hadron there is the center of this pion field distribution. And what you take is the collision of two pion field shockwaves. Then he calculates the radiated energy in the collision as a function of the single pion energy, and he finds the linear constant in the simplest case that he can take, which is a scalar free pion, massive. Then he finds that the average emitted pion energy grows linearly with a relativistic factor, so linearly with the square root s. He also finds that if you add the lambda phi fourth interaction, that behavior doesn't change, since the lambda phi fourth interaction doesn't change the high energy behavior of our theory. And as we'll see on the next page, this behavior is undesirable. So instead, he takes the Dirac-Bohn infield action given here, so square root 1 plus d phi squared plus m squared phi squared with a dimensional constant, and then he finds that the average single emitted pion energy is almost constant, almost equal to m phi, and just grows like a log of the relativistic factor. And then he says, well, the pion field wave function should be proportional to e minus rm pi, and he takes as an assumption that seems reasonable that the inelasticity of the process, so the radiated energy divided by the incoming energy, is proportional to the pion wave function overlap, so it should go like e to the minus bm pi. Then you find the maximum impact parameter for which the radiated energy is the average emitted pion energy, and then sigma is phi b max squared, and you find just the saturation of the Frassat bound, but only if the average emitted pion energy is a constant. If it goes like root s would cancel, so the sigma would just be a constant, so that's not good. So it is essential that one uses the higher derivative Dirac-Bohn infield action to find the saturation of the Frassat bound. So we need some nonlinear corrections here. And of course, this model was for a pion, but it will as well apply in the case where we have a light as blue ball. This didn't really depend much on the fact that it was a pion, this model. So this is the case that most of us were treating, the case of theory on wells. So in the dual theory, we have almost the same picture. We have two objects, two particles that scatter in the dual. As I said, in the limit, in the maximum behavior, one scatters effectively things on the infrared grain. So this is a four-dimensional scattering. You have these two particles of some characteristic size, but at high enough energy, as Hoff suggested, the size of the particles become irrelevant, and the only thing of relevance is the gravitational field around it. And they scattered to these two gravitational field shockwaves. And they also have a mass scale, which is the mass scale of the Lightest Kolchak-Klein mode that is mapped to the Lightest Lubov mode, so exactly as we wanted. And as Heisenberg said, the wave function goes like an exponential, characterized by the relevant mass scale. In this case, the mass scale of the light that came on. So this is the shock wave on the infrared brain that is mapped to the fine field shock wave. But moreover, now we have a, so Heisenberg had this nice model, but he had a number of assumptions. In particular, he assumed that the inelasticity of the process is proportional to the Pion wave function overlap. But now we have an exact mechanism to calculate Vmax from this phi. We have the mechanism of gravity, this trapped surface calculation. So this is, gives the Heisenberg model and explains what was unexplained there. So, but the next point is, if this model maps so precisely and it's four dimensions to four dimensions, on the dual side we create a black hole. Correspondingly, there should be some sort of soliton, I mean, okay, the word soliton maybe is not good to describe, some lump of the pion field which is created in the collision that then decays into free pions, the way you create a black hole that then decays. And we saw that one needed the full nonlinear gravity to derive this maximum impact parameter, and correspondingly in the Heisenberg model one really needed the full nonlinear DBI action to calculate the saturation of the Frassar bound. And a further point is that I talked about gravity mostly, but I said, so there was a very simple argument that the same will happen for brain bending, but then the radial action is nothing but the DBI action, nothing but, it can be rewritten in this way. So maybe even as a conjecture, I mean this is at max equal to zero, so maybe even as a conjecture we can say that the nonlinear generalization of radial stabilization could be found by just putting m squared inside the square root, like Heisenberg did. Seems very natural. Also, now that we saw that the physics for radial and for the gravity is so similar, maybe we can think of that the four-dimensional action for this massive Kolchak-Lyon graviton is also of Dirac-Bornier-Fell type. Now that's a complete conjecture, just the physics seems so similar, but there is some sort of evidence for it. On one hand, usual Einstein gravity, so the Einstein term plus the cosmological constant plus the topological term when written in first order form can be rewritten as a Dirac-Bornier-Fell action. And so various people, including Dessler and Gibbons, have looked at Dirac-Bornier-Fell action for gravity of this type. So maybe the good action for the Kolchak-Lyon graviton could be in terms of a background metric, then an object that's bilinear in the Kolchak-Lyon graviton, the rest of the contraction is done with the background metric, and some mass term for the Kolchak-Lyon graviton. Maybe.
How are you saying you would derive this? You're saying somehow this is what comes out of string theory?
No, I'm saying that this is just a pure guess, but a priori you should indeed calculate it in string theory, the same way as you calculate the Dirac-Bornier-Fell action. Now,
so
I don't know.
That's the string, well, the string action with the higher correction, you would have to resum into that, wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
We actually know leading order correctness to that roughly, just from the...
Well, if this is the action for a Kolchak-Lyon graviton on infrared brains, I'm not sure.
Well, yeah, I mean, we know the 10-dimensional, the first terms in the 10-dimensional.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
It's not clear to me. I mean, one still needs to do some work to find that. But I believe it's doable in principle, if not. So now let me try to describe to you what I believe corresponds to the soft Pomeroy behavior of gauge theories. I said that as an intermediate step between flat-space black holes and black holes in infrared brain, black holes should first feel the scale of ABS. Now, we can calculate the shockwave inside the ABS, and as I told you, the shockwave goes like 1 over r to the 6th. And correspondingly, we found that the cross-section, the gauge theory cross-section goes like x to 1/6. But I think there's a bit of a contradiction here when you think a little bit about what happens. So for flat phase black hole, sigma goes like this power. In D equal 5 would be S to 1 half, in D equal to 10 would be S to 1 7. So now if you're saying that first black holes fill flat phase, so S to 1 7, then they fill ABS 5, that would be S to 1 6, and then log squared S. That doesn't make much sense in gauge theory. You just have an exponent that first grows and then decays. That doesn't seem very reasonable to me.
Wait, in what regime are they looking like S to the 1 6?
If you fill first the scale, so you fill first black holes are in flat space, and then black holes in ABS 5. They first fill the curvature of ABS 5.
The ABS radius.
The
ABS
scale.
So I'm a little confused. So where does the 1 6 come from?
Oh, so you calculate the solution for the shockwave in ABS,
yeah,
and you find that it goes like one over r to the 6, and then by this track surface formalism, sigma goes like x to 1 of the 6.
And how much of a regime is there between where it hits the ABS radius and where you
well,
get into the log S behavior?
I'll discuss this a little bit more, but first of all, as I said, I don't quite believe this. Because it doesn't make sense, for the exponent first to grow and then to decay. But then another possibility would be that the gravity dual is always five-dimensional, in which case it would be S1 half going to S1 6 going to log squared S. But that would mean that the extra dimension is always so small as to be neglected. That doesn't seem reasonable to me either. And as I said, you know, the black hole should first, after filling flat space, should first feel the curvature of ABS, and only after that the infrared ring. So the only self-consistent solution that I can think of is to say that maybe the size in this infrared region, maybe the size of the extra dimensions is much larger than the size of ABS, because if it's of the same type, then you can just neglect the extra dimensions and you have the same problem as before. And so if this happens, that effectively says that in the infrared, the effective size grows with R. And if one does that, you can solve again for the shockwave in ABS V plus 1 plus a large space. And, you know, here you had 1 over R to this power, and now you just add some D bar flat dimensions. And so phi will go like 1 over I to 11 in this case. Yes.
So, okay, I'm confused because let's suppose that the size of the contact dimension is comparable to the ABS radius, which seems to get you into this trouble. Now, if you just look at sort of the behavior of black holes as a function of their energy, say, and look at how the radius grows, then I don't see where you get the power law behavior, because once you get the Schwarzschild radius and the ABS radius, then you have this, the logarithm is what you encounter for the of the black hole as a function.
No, the logarithm was in the case of the infrared brain. Now what happened is, so you have to solve for this shockwave in ABS.
Yeah.
And what happens is, you know, ABS increases in one side and decreases in the other side, the warp factor. Whereas on the infrared brain, they increase in both sides. So that's why on the infrared brain you get this exponential E minus MR, which turns into the log for the horizon. And in this case, you get the power law. So one repeats the same thing, and not surprisingly, even that phi goes like 1 over I to 11, the cross-section for, the gauge theory cross-section for corresponding black hole formation goes like S to 1 over that power, so 1 over 11. So now the behavior seems consistent, S to 1 7 to S to 1 11 going to log squared S. So let me now say, put all this together and say to you what I believe are the energy behaviors of some general gauge theories. So there's the scales involved are the following. There's the ABS scale, then there's the string scale, then the Planck scale, then will be the correspondence principle scale at which strings and black holes are when it goes from one description to the other. Then there's this scale at which the size of black holes become comparable to ABS size, which corresponds to this. So Moreover, in this very unlikely from my point of view situation that the gravity do is always five-dimensional, there would be two further scales, but I won't discuss that.
In the case of the tough primer is large, I mean, this ordering is the way they order,
right.
Then they're being separated.
Mm-hmm. So the energy scales will be this. As I said, the ADS scale, string scale, Planck scale, this new scale, and an unknown scale at which the black hole reaches the infrared brain. So what I claim are the energy regimes are the following. In the first energy regime, we just have hot scattering in a gravity dual corresponding to single graviton exchange, and the differential cross-section is Rutherford type. In regime 2, we'll just have regular behavior and nothing else. Above the Planck scale, we'll have this flat black hole in flat space that correspond to sigma going like S17. Above this energy scale ER and up to the unknown Frassard scale, sigma goes like S1811. And after that, we have the Frassard behavior. So now, let me say what I think happens in real QCD and compare with experiments. So, as I showed you, I said that string corrections, moreover, really alpha prime and GS corrections are small. We have found this by scattering string-corrected shockwaves of amatoplanar type. And these string corrections, of course, translate into one over n, one over g squared n corrections. So the results we had should apply to real QCD as well. More specifically, we found this exponentially small correction, when here we have the Schwarzschild radius. And you can derive an energy scale at which this becomes a order 1, and it's about Planck scale squared over ms. But this particular energy scale cannot really be trusted since my calculation here was in flat 4 dimensions. Otherwise, you know, it's very non-trivial how to calculate this. But I believe still, you know, the particular scale at which this exponent starts becoming very small should be comparable to the Planck scale. So at least, I believe at least above the energy scale ER, where the black hole size is equal to the ADS size, at least above that we should trust the analysis, and below that string corrections could be large at some point, so it's not clear. So what happens to the scales in QCD? Just trusting these formulas that we had before, the scale of the lightest glue ball is somewhere of the order of 1 GeV. The scale, then the Planck scale and the string scale are all of the same order, so somewhere between 1 and 2 GeV, all of these things. And this new scale, N squared M1, where the black holes reach ADS size, is about 10 GeV. And then there's this further Frassard scale at which the black holes reach the infrared brain. So I believe that the following thing happens. From the analysis we had before, we see that the first two regimes are non-existent, the first three scales collapse. But the regime 3 above 1-2 GeV but below 10 GeV, we create flat space black holes, and sigma should go like S17, which is this small power. But there could be string corrections, as I mentioned, in this regime. Also, for the strict 2-2 scattering, one still finds regular behavior, of course, in this regime. Above 10 GeV, we should create black holes in this ADS D plus 1 cross X V bar. And sigma, we've seen that goes like S1 over 11, which is this small power, 0.0909. And above the Frassard scale, we should have Frassard behavior. But the only thing that I want to point out at this point is that the coefficient of the Frassard behavior, pi over n pi squared, is about 60 millibonds. So pictorially, just to get an idea, in a log-log plot, one should have first 1/7 slope, then 1/11, and then Frassard regime, where the three scales are given here. So now let's see what experiment says. Experimentally, one found that the the cross-section for colliding A with B particles goes like this small power, epsilon, which is exactly one sigma away, I mean, our prediction is exactly one sigma away from this. So I said it should be 1 over 11, so that's 0.0909, and this is the experimental result. And there's, in here, the coefficient is between 10 and 35 millibars. Moreover, I said that the onset of this should be at about 10 GeV, and experimentally one finds that the onset is at 9 GeV. If you try to go to match this behavior at lower energies, you find that chi-squared goes a lot. So this was the situation until maybe 2 years ago, but now if you look in PDG, you see that people say instead of this behavior, they have put this behavior, reaction-dependent constant plus B log squared S, which seems to fit slightly better the data than the one above. But I believe this is just a fluke. First of all, the fit is just marginally better. And then this reaction-dependent constant takes these values here, but it's much larger than this beam here, which is 0.31. And so there's this unnatural hierarchy of scale between the two, this B and the maximum for SAR B, which is 60 millibar. Yes?
You see, this is really black holes, you would expect to see the same thing in this region for proton-proton and proton-antiproton, for example, I think. Right, because it's sort of the universal.
Right, and you do, but
so, okay, and you said, so the ZAB, is that supposed to be...
Yeah, so this depends on reactions. So for instance, proton kaon or something like this is a different constant.
Yeah.
But proton-proton and proton-antiproton is the same constant. It's just... They're actually hierarchical a little bit. It's not only that, but they subtract the contributions from some other exchanges which go down with energy. And so there's one which is odd, so C odd, so it, that changes. But
why in the gauge theory picture is the coefficient for the log one around pi?
In this Heisenberg model that I showed you, the one of the
Heisenberg model, mm-hmm. I don't know in this picture where the
Oh, in my gravity field picture? It's just the same idea.
Oh, wait, you mean on the gravity side or on the gauge theory side?
On the gauge theory side.
It's just the lightest excitation, and the soft behavior is...
I don't know where the bound comes from, but I don't see it in the picture.
Yeah.
No.
On the gauge theory side, it's a little hard to understand.
But I'm saying that the Heisenberg homology strikes correctly, then. Yes.
That's why the gravity argument is nice.
No, that's what I meant. The graph, where is m over m pi coming from?
It's right. I have 1 over m of the lightest excitation. In the case of lightest excitation was gravity, was the Kolta-Klein mass, and that just came from the fact that I had this E minus m1r in the shot there.
Pi comes?
Yeah.
And m1 is mapped to m pi, yeah.
It's from the leading behavior of the gravitational potential at long distance, and it's an exponential fall off because the gravitational mass, and it's whichever gravitational excitation has the least mass over its long distance.
Right, and that's a prion mass?
Well, it depends on the theory, basically.
Well, the prion. I think you have to take the prion of the blue balls because the prion is an open string. It's not a gravitational excitation. An intercept of one. Intercept of one won't saturate and won't give you a unitary problem. And so even though the pion is the rigorous bound, my interpretation is the actual physics that you would expect to see would be at the log square root times the lightest blue ball. Since the lightest blue ball is a factor of 10 heavier than the pion, maybe the factor of 100 in the cross section is
No, but in the case one has to couple the pion to the physics as well, and in the model Steve had, the radion is the one that dominates. So before the black holes reach the infrared brain, I would say the brain bending will reach the black holes first.
I see. So that's an open string state.
Yeah.
And so it's It's project, it's intercept in the sort of the extreme stream that would be one and not two. But it still gives you cross-arc behavior? I mean, that's kind of surprising, because cross-arc behavior, I mean, maybe,
well,
that's, maybe it's not
okay.
Maybe it's not surprising. But is that right? The Z is, it,
yeah.
Is usually described to things like the row trajectory and the pion trajectory, is that right?
I'm sorry?
The Z.
Yeah.
Is supposed to be the row and the pion trajectory.
Oh, no. In this way, it's just a model. I mean, actually, I find quite surprising. I mean, people say, well, one argument for introducing this constant is, you say, if you look at a bit better at the bound, it should be log squared IS or something like this, and then you look at it and you get that it should become constant. But, I mean, this is a subleading behavior after all, so it's not, you know, I mean, in this fit, to me, it seemed a little bit, you know, ad hoc. That's, I actually want to believe that this is not the right fit. And the reason these two are actually this close by, you can see just the expand this, you get 1 plus epsilon log s plus epsilon squared log squared s over 2. And if you do that, you get the right order of magnitude for these two things. So my question is, you know, there's a constant term, there's a scale hierarchy, and moreover, this fit extends to lower energies and not to higher ones. And I expect from the Heisenberg picture that the coefficient is actually close to 60 millibonds, because in the Heisenberg model it's exactly pi over n pi squared, so exactly 60 millibonds. So, I mean, of course, one other possibility that I don't really believe is that there should be some, there could be some combination of these two, but I don't really believe that. Oh, so the only thing that I want to say, now, I predict in this from this Heisenberg model, the way it maps to the dual, I predict that there should be some nonlinear soliton that then decays into free pions. But the energy regime is already studied, so it should have been observed by now. And I claim that it has. I claim that this is nothing but the Rigg fireball. So I claim that the Rigg fireball is this soliton that is dual to the black hole. And the black hole has temperature, so does the fireball. So let's try to calculate it, see what we can say about it. Well, using black hole thermodynamics, dm is tds, and then...
Yeah. You said the fireball, you mean this expanding fireball that goes out?
Well, of course, it's, you know, it's, it, there's some approximation involved in the sense that even in the gravity-dual collision, you have two shock waves colliding, you don't create a static black hole, you'll create some evolving object. The same as you see in the collision, you see some evolving object. But just for trying to get something concrete, I'll consider the object that you create is static. But that's, you know, that would be one part.
But there's really no guarantee, and that was the subject of some controversy, that the black hole that you would create on the gravity side actually is stable.
Okay. Doesn't just evaporate immediately.
Well, no, no. Well, there's a question. There are questions of classical stability and quantum stability. There's no guarantee that it's even classically stable. You can create this thing, and it may sort of, well, in some sense, sink into the brain. Yeah. Picture back and forth with subsequent events.
Sorry, it seems that the brain therefore disappears. Or it's still a black hole, just someplace else.
Well, the horizon gets sort of closer and closer to the brain, and at some point, your approximations break down.
Oh, I see.
But it gets sort of thinner and thinner.
It's very hard. Very
hard to do something else.
It's very hard to see what really happens, though, because the geometry is so singular, and it's not clear what a good way to approximate.
More work should definitely.
Yeah. Anyway, so assuming that you create this black hole there, so the entropy is area of the four in Planck units. So then, and area is pi r horizon squared. So then dn should have this expression. Now, if you would assume the following dimensional relation, that dr horizon squared is dm over m1 with a coefficient in front, then you would get this expression for the temperature. Now let's see why should we have this relation. Well, one can first look at the linearized solution for gravity, and, you know, say horizon where is linearized solution is of order 1. This gives you the right coefficient, but then some extra junk that doesn't look like it. So that's not quite. But that's okay, because there's no reason to expect the linearized solution is the same near the horizon. instead, one can use what historically was done. I mean, Hawking first calculated the temperature and then derived the entropy. So if you just look at the Hawking's flat four-dimensional calculation, he found that the temperature is the surface gravity at the horizon divided by 2 pi. And under very mild assumption about how the solution should look like near the horizon, one would find that this surface gravity will be approximately equal to the m1, to the mass of the lightest graviton. That corresponds to the formula we had above with a equal to 1/8. Of course, in here I just transplanted this formula from flat four dimensions, and the actual case is nothing like it. It's a black hole on the infrared brain. So one should really redo completely. So not only find the solution for the black hole on the infrared brain, but redo Hawking's analysis for it. At least now I have an argument to believe this. And there's a simpler argument to believe this. Namely, we're in a regime where gravity is dominated by the exponential, e minus m1r. So the only mass scale of relevance in the problem is this m1, the mass of gravity. So therefore, temperature should be the only relevant mass scale. So now we have this formula with A that needs to be computed. But for the sake of argument, just believing that this is the simplest thing you can put, if A equal to 1, m1 will be mapped to the pi on mass. And then if you calculate this quantity that multiplies here, is 175.76 MeV. That's almost exactly what is observed. So maybe once you calculate that A, it should be 1, as it is simpler, as I hope.
Can I ask a question here?
Yeah.
If I take massless force, the prediction is that the firewall temperature goes to 0.
No. Yeah, so I had this question before. So it's not quite like that. I mean, the point is, of course, if you have a massless pion, what would happen? I mean, first of all, it's not clear that this is the temperature of the freeze-out, right? It's not the temperature of the phase transition. It's not completely clear what the phase transition has to do.
I don't think with zero temperature will have freeze-out in the quark on mass.
So what I believe happens is the following, and this is more or less, I think, what also one sees from lattice. So these two things, the temperature of the freeze-out and the temperature of the confinement transition, will be coupled for a while as you start lowering the pi on mass. But after that, the pi on mass should be coupled from the freeze-out temperature. So you'll have this object being formed there, but its temperature will not be the confinement transition anymore. I could explain to you that more in detail, but
presumably at some point you hit on the gravity side the string scale or something, and get those pictures among other things.
Well, for one thing, when the Frassat bond is pi over m pi squared, so when pi, m pi goes light enough, there's no bond anymore, so you're not in the Frassat case anymore. So that's what really happens, right? So as you decrease m pi, or whatever, the mass of the gravity on the other side, this object suddenly doesn't, it's not on the infrared brain anymore. You don't reach the Frassat bond anymore. So, indeed, this temperature should also be from the lattice, also about the temperature of the chiral restoration and deconfinement transition, which from the lattice, I believe, is somewhere between 117 and 180 MeV. So we're going to say a little bit later what I believe is the relation to that. But first, let me give you some more arguments for what I said. An object that is of quite a lot of interest is the ratio of shear viscosity over entropy. And as I'm sure you've heard a few times by now, there's a conjecture bound for the fact that this eta over s is greater or equal to 1 over 4 pi. And there's a theorem by Liu and Bichel that for black holes in gravity duals, this bound is saturated and eta over s is 1 over 4 pi. And at RIC, if people take the hydrodynamic model, which is a big if apparently, so not everybody agrees that this is a correct description. But for a hydrodynamic model, one finds that this ratio is somewhere of the order of 0.1 to 0.3. So in the right, and in the right regime for these two things to be equal. And you see, if I want to say that this is actually a dual black hole, they should be equal. So that's fine. Moreover, at the core of the fireball, there's some object. I said colored glass condensate, but it seems that people disagree of what to call the object at the beginning, at the core of the fireball. Let me just keep it for a moment. But the interesting point is not what you call it, but the fact that this object absorbs hard scattered particles, phenomenon known as jet quenching. So the idea is that you expect a large number of perturbative QCD interactions, you can calculate how much, which produce jets, but you see much less. And the explanation for that is you have this fireball sitting there, so then the jets, the perturbative QCD interactions, would absorb, if you have a particle with large transverse momentum, it will absorb this transverse momentum over the distance of the fireball. That's how in particular you know that the fireball at the core is highly interacting. It's not some perturbative quark-gluon plasma, it's some object that interacts a lot. But now, and there's a very important question is, how do you explain this jet quenching? But I say that jet quenching is very simple in this picture. It's nothing but the information paradox. Namely, stuff gets into the black hole, information in terms of hard scattered particles, and only radiation comes out, so only soft particles come out. That would also mean that it would be very hard to probe the soliton by having extra particles that, you know, from the beam just colliding with the fireball, because that would effectively probe the black hole. But one could hope that to probe the formation and decay regimes of black hole, even if not the black hole itself. Finally, I said, here I said that, you know, one expects to have this temperature of the freeze-out to be related also to the temperature of the confinement in some sense. So how do we explain that? Well, this soliton or fireball is dual to a black hole. So you bang two things together, and then you just create a ball of gravity, and there's nothing else. So what could excitations be inside? Well, just gravity ripples. There's nothing else left. But gravity ripples at short enough distances will interact with the Newtonian potential, and the corresponding thing in the case of brain bending. And this Newtonian potential, when you translate it into QCD, you get a Coulomb-like potential. And that's really what you mean by deconfinement, that you have free quarks and gluons, quarks and gluons interacting with the Coulomb potential. Of course, in here, you know, I had some objects of some mass, so these are some details which I cannot really describe in this way. What are the actual excitations of these things, how big they are, and so on. But at least I have some picture of deconfinement, that there is deconfinement inside. So finally, let me conclude. So what have I done? I have described to you how to use Eichel-Brzechsel shockwave scattering to calculate black hole creation in the gravity field in the general framework of Polchinski and Strassler, and we obtained the following energy regimes for gauge theories. Between the ABS scale and the string scale, we've obtained single graviton exchange given here. Between the string scale and the Planck scale, just radial behavior and nothing else. Between the Planck scale and this scale, flat space black hole production with sigma going like F17. Above this scale and until a scale that I cannot calculate without knowing the gravity dual, sigma is S11, that is this small power. After that, Frassard behavior, and I said that in real QCD, the first three scale collapse to about 1 or 2 GeV, and this scale is the only one that remains, is 10 GeV, and also the unknown Frassard scale. And the experimental soft Pomeroy matches very well with the prediction. I described to you the Heisenberg model for saturation of the Frassard bound, and I said that it maps exactly to the dual model, and we predicted that there should be some nonlinear parallel field soliton, or rather ball, and that this object has already been observed at Rick, and it's the fireball that one sees. And I tried to calculate for you the temperature, and I did only up to an overall constant, which if you put it equal to 1, gets very good agreement to experiment, but of course one has to really calculate it. But at least, you know, there's some hope. Then the Coulomb potential inside the soliton is mapped to the neutron potential inside the black hole. The interior of the fireball is mapped to the black hole interior. Jet quenching is the information paradox. And therefore, I would like to tell you that maybe Rick is a string theory testing machine analyzing black hole creation and decay and probing the black hole interior. Thank you.